ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to The Midpoint. We have a living sporting legend on the podcast this week. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce double Olympic champion, twice European champion, multiple World Cup gold medal winner, Helen Glover. Helen has been such a dominant force in women's rowing, and her partnership with Heather Stanning became the stuff of legend at London 2012 when they became the first British women to win an Olympic gold medal. Then they wrote themselves into the history books again 4 years later when they successfully defended their Olympic title. Alongside her sporting achievements, Helen's also raising three young children with her husband, TV naturalist Steve Backshall. She's nearing the midpoint, not quite there yet, but still eyeing up the Paris Olympics later this year. So we just had to get her on the podcast. And with so much emphasis now on keeping our brains as well as our bodies healthy, we're going to speak to psychologist and author Kimberly Wilson. Kimberly's first book was called How to Build a Healthy Brain. So she's going to tell us all about the role exercise plays in all of that. First up, here's the legend that is Helen Glover. It is such a thrill to have you on The Midpoint. Congratulations on just being still in this sport, because I'm so excited that I'm excited you're on the precipice of being in The Midpoint, actually, because that means you get to come on The Midpoint. Because having followed your career from when you just seemed to be a slip of a thing, you know, back in 2012, I can't believe we're here. Can you?
I cannot believe we're here. It feels like so long ago. And I think actually a lot of the conversations we were having together back then was about how young I was and how I just started in this sport. And I never thought I would be here this far down the road.
And that in itself is an achievement, isn't it? You know, having longevity in any career is an achievement. But in sport, it is so brutal. It's so cutthroat. It's so physically demanding. It's hard to have that greatness, that longevity and that repetition of success, let alone combining it with being a mother. So, you know, so many firsts have been smashed by you to win the first Olympic gold as a woman for Great Britain in rowing, and then to back it up, and then to go to an Olympic Games as a mother. The word trailblazer seems almost just a little bit too pathetic, you know, with all that in mind. What's the motivation this time?
Do you know, I don't see it as trailblazing in a way. I feel that I'm stepping on the stones that other people have laid for me. You know, I really felt that in London, that so many people were watching from the stands who had been, you know, the first female rower, in their competition, in their day. And I feel like it's just kind of standing on their shoulders, really. So, yeah, it does feel surreal to be talked about in those terms. But, I think it is all of those things. It's brutal and it's tough, but it's also really addictive. You know, I really want to be here and want to be doing it. And I think while there's that itch to scratch, I want to keep doing it.
Okay, let's talk about where you are right now. You're in Portugal, you're on a camp. I said to you when we were just setting this podcast up, you know, how hard is the training? And, you know, your face said it all. So for people who are listening, have got no idea what it takes, tell us about this training camp and the hours you're putting in.
So the reason we go away on training camp is that it takes away things like doing your cooking, walking to the shops, any other daily life activities are put to the side so you can just purely train. And that means putting your body through whatever you can stretch to for about 16 days of camp. So we wake up, we'll do about a 2-hour row first thing in the morning after breakfast, then refuel, get out onto the water again. And this time it's for timed pieces. So this is against other crews, other British crews. And that's kind of really when you're in the most pain. It's kind of race practice, really. And then finally, in the evenings at around 5 o'clock, we do a weight session. So we just do a good solid lifting session. So it's 3 sessions a day. And then being on training camp, between those sessions, you're also getting physio, doing video analysis and all those things that you actually have a bit more time for than you normally would at home.
And you're also not putting the kids to bed, doing reading with them, having to, you know, and on the one hand, obviously that's, I imagine, a great kind of feeling of sadness that you miss those things. But obviously physically, it's very, very tiring.
to be looking after three young children. So you kind of, the quid pro quo is you get more out of that training block when you're away from the family?
Yeah, definitely. And it's really interesting because in the run up to a training camp, I have this feeling of I'm not looking forward to going away, but I'm craving that rest. I'm craving that reset and recovery. And I get out here and maybe have 48 hours where I enjoy the reset and enjoy not having to always be on top of a timetable. And then I just really start to miss them again. And so, yeah, there's definitely an element of more recovery, but also more kind of emotional tugging as well while I'm away.
Lots of calls, I imagine, lots of FaceTimes. They know exactly what you're doing. I mean, they've lived on the water. They've lived with you being this person their whole lives. So how do they process that? What are you hearing from them?
It's quite interesting because I think what they see is really the background, the day-to-day that most people don't see. They see me on the rowing machine and they see me lifting weights and I do a lot of my training at home and they see that. And I think now that we're in an Olympic year, things have changed and there's conversations around the Olympics and they pick up on things. And I think they are adding together what it is that mummy does. And it's quite cool, I think, that they've seen the groundwork and they'll then hopefully see the end result come Paris.
Yeah.
Because that's a big reason why I started. But yeah, I think they're probably a bit baffled by it most days. Like, why are you spending that long in the rowing machine?
But now they're at school,
I hope it all makes sense.
They must know this is not what everybody else's mummy is doing. So that must start to, you know, it starts to kind of become, they become aware that this isn't normal.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think that my oldest, Logan, actually, he's 5 and he's actually started to feel quite proud as well. I think I've just seen this sense of, oh, other people think it's really great what you're doing. So therefore, it's quite cool.
And the twins are 4.
Yeah.
So, I mean, anybody having twins of 4 and another child at 5 is already in a whole load of work and, you know, sleep deprivation and your life just feels a bit like chaos. I mean, I only have the twins, but a friend of mine did the same thing as you and had 3 in effectively 18 months. And that's just hard enough on its own. You've got to do all of that alongside somebody who supports you. You couldn't do this on your own. Steve is obviously an enormous part of a team getting Helen to her next Olympics. So tell me a little bit about the conversation you had with him when you said, I'm going to come out of retirement yet again.
Yeah, I mean, I think he saw this one coming. I think when I had, after Rio, 4 years out and 3 children and the twins were newborns when COVID hit. So that's when I came out of retirement for the first time. And I have to admit that was quite left field. That wasn't really the expected move. This time round, I think it was probably more expected and it was probably more of a joint decision, actually. I think we both saw the potential of it. We both saw it was something we can do. A lot of the questions have been answered and put to bed by going to Tokyo. And this time around, especially with a shorter Olympic cycle, because COVID moved it to a 3-year cycle, had a year out after Tokyo. So it suddenly becomes this tantalizing 2-year project rather than this scary 4-year one. So yeah, but his enthusiasm and his involvement. I'm sure some days he regrets or questions, at least, especially right now when I'm in Portugal and he's on the school run and doing all the things that he's doing on his own. But I think he relishes it in a way as well. I think actually he does recognise this is really special time for him to have with the children as well.
Having a supportive partner in this situation with 3 children is vital. You couldn't do this, could you, without a support unit around you, which seems a little bit unfair still, because I don't think any questions that were ever asked of Steve Redgrave like that, were they, you know, about what's going on at home when he was aiming to win his final gold medal in Sydney. So we've come so far, but we still haven't become normal. It's not normal for female athletes to turn up in GB colours at an Olympic Games with children at home. And I don't know how many there'll be in the team this summer, but there'll be a handful, I would imagine, if that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when men have families, it's just this fairly organic expectation that their career doesn't even take a hiccup, you know? And I think that for obvious reasons, a woman's career will be affected because, you know, you physically have a baby. But then I do think the change comes after that. The change has to come after that when it's not a surprise that they think about continuing. I think that many women, just like in the workplace, many women will choose not to return. But I think that for anyone who wants to consider returning, I think that I'd love to see it get to the point where there's not the flicker of a raise of an eyebrow about it. It's just something that can be made possible with the expectation of it will not be easy. But yeah, I do think things are changing. There is a sea change that I think is happening. And it's nice to be on that side of the conversation.
And how did GB Rowing kind of accept that when you put this to them, this is how you're going to work? You mentioned before you're doing some of your work at home. A lot of people are working from home these days. It's slightly different when you're an international athlete, but it can be done. Were they quite receptive to that plan?
It was really interesting because the deciding factor in me returning was COVID. You know, I had the twins in January of 2020. I was going to be watching the Olympics, breastfeeding the twins on the sofa. You know, that was where that year was headed. And then when the games was moved and everyone was training at home, it just opened up an opportunity that never would have been presented to me before. Before, you had to be in training, you had to be present. Essentially, if the coaches didn't see you train, it didn't count. You know, and then there was this shift from, everyone was from training from home. So I kind of said, well, why shouldn't I be giving it a go? So I kind of did that under my own steam. And I thought, if I get good enough, then they can't really question it. And so that was a really unique way of doing it. It kind of worked, but just for a short, it wasn't a long-term solution. This time around, I've had to create a long-term solution. I'm currently rowing in a four. You know, I've got three other people that I have to show up for and I have to be my best for. So I think I've been so lucky that the head coach and my own coach are really open and understanding. And essentially, they have worked out that when I am the best mum I can be, that's always when I'm the best rower I can be. I'm always producing my best results when I'm happiest at home. And I know that I have just done my very best there. And so there's just been a really nice kind of relationship where I've said, I want to be at every school pickup. So that means starting some of my training a little bit earlier, doing a lot of more training from home if it's on the land. And so far, my teammates have been really receptive to that. And I just feel like if I am the best I can be, I want you to want me in the boat so badly that you'll have that bit of flexibility for me.
Well, I know you're going to say you're not, but that is trailblazing, Helen. That, you know, that is laying down a new marker.
I hope so. I do. I did look back and reflect on Tokyo, and I did think, what has changed from me doing this? And the answer was nothing. The answer was, it was just a really unique, I say nothing. Okay, so maybe people would have been a bit more open about wanting to come back. But in terms of practically, the situation was the same. And this time around, I do feel like when I leave, somebody will be able to say, you know, there will be somebody else who comes along and says, this is how it worked and this is how the team worked it. And it wasn't just a one-off. And I do feel proud that I feel like that change has been made.
And tell me about the other women in the boat and how they kind of, you know, their lives must be so different to yours and how they perceive your world and, you know, how that all works together as characters, as, you know, as chemistry.
It's funny because in some ways, I think the girls on the team do not have a clue what it's like when I leave training. And I cannot blame them for that, because when I was in my 20s, I had no idea what it was like being a parent. And I think until you are one, you kind of can't really compare anything to it. You know, we'll go home and everybody else will watch a film or be on the sofa or have their dinner. And I've got to take them to swimming club, then tennis, then somehow trying to cook a meal in between. But I just think that our lives are unbelievably different, but somehow it works.
Yeah, and you get a lot of energy from them, I'm sure. You know, and their passion for the family and everything else that comes with it. You know, that is energy giving, isn't it? To a certain, it drains you a bit, but it does give you energy and it gives you inspiration, I'm sure. So we talked about the emotional challenges and the logistical challenges. How physically different is this experience to the build up to 2012? How much harder does it feel, or does it? You know, there's all this talk about the hormonal bounce you get post-pregnancy, is that kind of dissipated now, or are you still feeling those benefits?
It's really interesting, and I'd love to, I think there's another layer of research that needs to be done, because the post-pregnancy, the post-childbirth body is really fascinating, because sometimes I feel so strong, and many days I'm completing these training sessions on so little sleep and so little recovery, and still getting the scores that I would have got before. And I don't really understand it. So there are those positives, but I think the negatives are things like I've definitely had more injuries since returning. And I don't know if that's because of going through childbirth or whether it's because of losing recovery time and probably quality sleep and things like that. So yeah, there are negatives, but I think that they're outweighed by the positives of physically feeling strong and feeling like I can go through a lot. But then also mentally, I think I've compartmentalized the importance of what this is and how much I'm willing to put into it versus the most important thing, which is my home life. And weirdly, that hasn't actually had a negative effect on the rowing. It's just kind of made it a more of a balance, I guess.
And you said before it can be addictive. So, you know, that's why you guys keep coming back, keep putting yourself through it, because the highs are so high when it, you know, when you race, when you win, and when you feel that absolute kind of nadir of brilliance and you have that gold medal around your neck. But those moments are fleeting, right? They're really tiny in the scheme of things. Now you've been through retirement a couple of times and you've come out. Do you worry less about what life is like on the other side? Because you know there is life on the other side than, say, the young athlete who wondered if she'd ever achieve those highs again.
I don't know. In a way, I suppose I worry more because I've come back twice now. So there is something pulling me back. And I want to reach the level of closed book satisfaction that I've seen in other people. I've seen in Heather Stanning, you know, the pairs partner I had in London and in Rio, and she walked away. And I just have never had a conversation with her where she's alluded to regrets. And I want that. But I also know that hasn't been my time yet. And I guess our timelines are going to be different. Everyone's timelines are going to be different. And mine will probably come after Paris. And maybe I'll have to work for that closure. I don't know. But yeah, in a way, things are easy when you're part of it and things are scary when you're out of it.
But having to come out of it as a mother, as a woman, with a family there, you know, you're not thinking, a lot of women retire and then think it's time to have a family now. You know, that family's there waiting for you. That must be some source of comfort, you know? You've got your personal life in order.
Yeah, totally. And I also do feel like I could get injured tomorrow and return to my family with total positivity. Whereas if I had a career-ending injury, you know, mid my career 10 years ago, that would have been devastating with, I guess, really nothing to fall back on. Mm. So yeah, there are things that it gives you kind of that closure and comfort with, yeah.
Because you must have seen many rowers have to retire or leave their careers at a point, you know, they're taken out of the system for, you know, not hitting the metrics, the targets they need to, without having achieved what you've achieved and what they set out to achieve. And the difficulty that a lot of sports people find in closing their careers down and feeling a sense that they haven't achieved what they hoped they had. And that is still one of the really tough things, I think, to navigate for any sports person, isn't it? Especially an Olympian, I think, where it's not automatic.
And I do think that's also, it's another positive around women coming back or women staying in sport, because I do think that there's this danger that a lot of people feel like they've put so many things on the sideline for their sport. And then when you don't get the result, for whatever reason it is, you've put so many things to the back burner for an end result you may or may not get. Whereas if there is this kind of openness to being able to run family life and sport life, all these things parallel, then there is less of a gulf that you fall into when you leave the sport. Yeah. Mm. I do think it comes down to choice. I think choice is really freeing. And that when you feel that you're pigeonholed, it can be scary. And lots of people will choose not to have children. Of course they will choose not to have children during their career or ever or however they want. But I do think that even those people who choose not to at that moment in time, knowing they have the choice to do that is really important. And it's also really empowering.
And you mentioned Heather before. What does she think about what you're doing for the second time?
Heather thinks I am absolutely crazy. Mainly that's because she is so far removed now from the world that we lived in. I'm sitting right now in a room Heather and I probably shared 10 years ago in the run up to London. You know, honestly, I'm kind of still living this life we had in our 20s, which she thinks is crazy. But I couldn't choose a more supportive friend to be kind of on the end of a phone to. It's actually great having somebody who totally gets it. She's also got two children similar ages to mine. So someone who totally gets it, who totally gets me and is not surprised at all that knowing me, I'm still doing this.
When you think back to those beautiful days of 2012, that glorious summer and the build up to that Olympics, the pair of you going into the unknown, you know, and uncharted waters, quite literally, what's the difference between you and that person?
I think there was probably a level of desperation to the way that I trained and the way that I rode back then. There was a level of, I do remember I was walking to the shops and it was probably 3 months before the London Olympics. I had a very vivid thought, which was, if I just win the Olympics, I will never be sad again. It was like it was the answer to my prayers.
It was a panacea for every question life had thrown.
Yeah. And then you experience life. And I now know that training for Paris in 6 months or so time is a great thing to be doing. It's something I am so privileged to be doing. But it's not going to change the world. It's not going to change my life significantly. And I just think that they're really different perspectives. And I think the me of back then would have thought that wouldn't work. That wouldn't make me fast enough. That's not got the fire burning passion. But the fire burning passion is still there. It's just there in moments where it needs to be, not in this kind of really intense 24/7 person that I was before, I think.
Do you think you're a nicer person, a better person, or a person who's easier to be around? I mean, you were the loveliest person always, but I don't know, that kind of intensity can make people quite hard to be around if you're not operating on their level of intensity.
I think around racing, I know that definitely Steve found it quite hard around racing coming up to Rio, that I was, the closer we got to racing, the more kind of closed off I would be, or negative almost. I was just quite stressful to be around, not in my kind of demeanor, but just in, I would kind of sow seeds of doubt around the people around me just to limit expectations. And I think that was probably quite a stressful way to live with somebody. Whereas now I think I have noticed in the run up to racing, partly for the children, I don't want them to experience stress. I don't want them to experience secondhand stress at all. I just want the days to be normal and to be nice. And so I think that it takes me away from that. And it kind of just makes me mum and makes me more of a constant, I guess.
And in terms of the physical side of what you're doing right now, you know, your body has obviously been through a lot with two pregnancies, and one of those a twin pregnancy. And you've talked about being able to put yourself, you know, through really tough periods of training. A lot is being talked about now about the effect of a menstrual cycle on training, a lot more than it ever has been. Some high profile female athletes, Dina Asher-Smith springs to mind, has talked a lot about that. Have you had an opportunity to kind of investigate how that affects your cycle? You know, is that something that rowing is looking at?
Yeah, rowing's actually doing amazingly because we're taking big strides into that world. And the things that we're finding out is amazing. How even when, you know, my body weight can be constant, my energy could be okay, but we're doing blood tests to find out, actually, I might be massively underfueling. And then therefore that can lead to either underperformance or injuries or really long-term, quite significant problems. And when I first started, it wasn't really discussed. I didn't really have periods. I kind of just thought, well, I'm training hard, so that's going to happen. But yeah, for a long time, that would have just been the kind of the norm. Whereas now it's so healthy that it's turned, in a very short period of time, it's turned around straight away to, actually, the norm is to have healthy cycles, not to just keep going and assuming you're training hard because you're not having periods.
And do the training plans change on the basis of your cycles at all? Or I mean, imagine with four of you in a boat, you've probably become quite aligned, have you, in terms of your cycles?
Yeah, we generally have to stay quite aligned. I think that's actually quite a good way in of forcing us or making us really aware of what we need our bodies to be doing, so you're not letting down your teammates. And our team doctor has been really proactive on making sure people are on top of these things and are being proactive in what they can do. So, for example, for me, my energy consumption was way higher than we thought it might be, because we hadn't accounted for how much I'm on my feet running around after the children. Probably the mental load you carry as a parent as well. So my energy was like a lot higher than it ever had
been. So you had to eat more, basically, to fuel more.
Yeah.
And you already have to fuel low. I mean, give people an example of the calorie intake you're on at the moment.
So on training camp out here, on about 6,000 calories a day. And I can sometimes even be more than that. So it is a bit of a perk of the job as well, because I do like eating.
So. I was going to say, does it take the joy at all out of mealtimes, or is it just always lovely that you're allowed to have that extra piece of bread and the teller on it?
Sometimes it can. You can sit there and feel like this is a chore. But mostly, the great thing is that, you know, I've got a real sweet tooth and I love chocolate and things like that. And I can eat
and
plenty
of
that.
And they're all permissible within those calories, are they? Because they're just being burnt straight away.
I try to eat as healthily as possibly can. But when I look at the volume that I'd have to eat to kind of get about 6,000 calories, some of that has to come from the foods that I want to eat as well.
It can't all be chicken breasts.
No, exactly.
And what about at home? How does that affect what the family eats in terms of, you know, do you sit down together as a five?
Yeah, we try to. It does depend who's home. When Steve's away, I have to admit the cooking stand slips quite a lot.
Oh, really? So chief chef?
He's chief chef. So when he's home, it's pretty good. And he'll do something like a big spaghetti bolognese for the family, but, you know, kind of make mine and his a bit more fancy and more basic for the children. We'll tend to try and eat just one meal and maybe change it slightly for me and Steve. But it's definitely something which is better when he's around.
And is he planning on some huge expedition to Borneo or something on the back of the Olympics so he can go off and do his thing?
He's going to have a busy year next year because he has taken quite a lot of time off, especially running into the summer. He's got a lot of time off to kind of have the children as I'm doing my preparations. So, you know, next year he's going to have to kind of make up for it. But I get back from training camp. He goes away for an expedition. I think he's going to Mexico somewhere. And then when he gets back, I'm away again. So it's we're kind of high-fiving on the way out the door at the moment.
Oh my gosh. And who steps in then? You've got a local family and things who can kind of help out, or are you single mumming?
I will be single mumming while Steve's away. The twins are at nursery and Logan's at school. So I do make sure I'm there for pickup. That's how I make it work in terms of actually the logistics, but it's also how I make it work in terms of my emotional capacity. You know, if they're out of school, if they're out of nursery, I do want to be there, especially knowing that I've got these training camps coming up.
Yeah, it's incredible how you do it, honestly, because I think a lot of people who are listening who work and juggle careers know just how tough that can be. But to do it with the physical demands of what you're doing at the moment as well is brilliant, and it is trailblazing.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
I'm going to bring in our expert now, Kimberly Wilson, and she has written many books, many papers on the brain, how to build a healthy brain being one of them. Welcome back to The Midpoint, Kimberly.
And hello.
Today, I'd like you to talk a little bit to us about why exercise is so important for a healthy brain, because reports about Alzheimer's coming out and about new proteins found. And actually, one of the questions that was asked of one of the journalists was basically kind of how people can ward off or help their brain stay healthy for longer. And interestingly, the doctor said, think healthy brain, healthy heart. So all the things you do for a healthy heart will give you the benefits for a healthy brain, effectively. So what is another motivator for people then? Give them a big motivation as to why exercise is so important.
There are so many, and I will try to be concise. And it splits across. Essentially, exercise is a real tonic for both the brain and mental health, so what emerges from brain health. And so from physical activity, you get lots of kind of physical and chemical responses. So the physical responses are this increase in blood flow, what's called perfusion in the brain. And what that brings with it, of course, is oxygen, nutrients, energy, which helps improve the efficiency of your brain cells. And particularly in the front of your brain, the prefrontal cortex. And what we see after things that increase perfusion, like exercise, like eating berries, is that people have better executive function. So they have better memory, they have better impulse and self-control. They're much more cognitively flexible, so they can move from one thing to another without losing efficiency. So you get those kind of physical effects, but then you get things like a reduction in cortisol, a reduction in those kind of stress hormones. And that's what makes exercise so effective for managing stress and anxiety. It brings down those stress hormones whilst at the same time increasing things like endorphins, your endogenous, your inbuilt cannabinoids. So that's what gives you that kind of runner's high, that boost, that kind of joyous feeling you get. You get increases in dopamine. It just across the board, essentially. I don't talk about panaceas, but essentially exercise is a real tonic for the brain.
So that obviously is something that anybody who exercises will understand. You know, they understand that release of endorphins. I'm not sure that Helen gets endorphins anymore from exercise because she does so much of it. But I've been talking a lot recently about, I'm doing a half marathon coming up and I hadn't run for a long time. And I've started getting runner's high again. You know, I do a lot of exercise, but there is a difference, I think, from running and from exercise that uses a lot of cardio, a lot of parts of the body. Do you still get that, Helen, that kind of boost when you finish a training session?
I think I probably am a little more immune to it. I do remember experiencing it when I'd had my time out. I'd retired after Rio. And I remember thinking after maybe 9-10 months or so, I really need to start getting fit again and maybe running once a day. And I felt euphoric after it and I felt amazing after it. But I think, yeah, now probably the daily grind has made it less, but it does mean almost the peaks are higher and the troughs are lower.
And in terms of, so these are the short-term kind of hits of that endorphin. Long-term, in terms of the brain's health and warding off dementia and memory issues, how much exercise should people be doing? What, you know, what's the stage where it's too late? Is it ever too late to get those effects?
I like to say that it's never too late. Up until the point where someone is diagnosed really with moderate Alzheimer's disease, dementia, it's really never too late. So really you should just be trying to stick to the NHS recommendations of 150 minutes of moderate exercise, so about half an hour every day, a mixture of aerobic and resistance training. So aerobic gives you that lovely blood flow improvements, but also resistance training, so important, particularly for women, because resistance training, those growth factors, so those chemicals that are released to help build muscle, cross into the brain, they cross across the blood-brain barrier and they protect your neurons. And that seems to be one of the reasons why people who stay physically active have larger overall brain volume. So they retain that brain volume as they age, because your brain starts to shrink as you age. So they retain their brain volume, but they also retain neuroplasticity. So that's your brain's ability to change and grow in response to experience, you know, the things that you do, the challenges you face, the learning and all of those sorts of things and novel experiences that you have. And we know that neuroplasticity is associated with reduction in depression. So people who have low turnover of this process called neurogenesis, making new brain cells, tend to be at higher risk of depression. But also that neuroplasticity, that neurogenesis, is associated with protection against Alzheimer's disease, a much slower rate of brain aging. So essentially, as long as you can, you know, keep moving, do what you can, try to make it a combination of aerobic activity and resistance activity. Obviously, do exercises that you enjoy. It shouldn't be a chore as much as possible. But if you can stay active, then you're really, really supporting your long-term brain health.
Enjoyment. I see, you know, I'm having a problem. You don't have to really enjoy it. You know, like I don't really enjoy running, but it's the what's coming later, isn't it? You know, there's a reward coming down the track. I know what you're saying.
Sure. No, I mean, you don't have to be like skipping through it. Like, it's fine to work hard. It's fine to grunt. It's fine to find it. You know, there's
a bit tough.
Absolutely. And there's a real benefit in that kind of the experience of the effort effort. But I suppose if you're someone who hates burpees,
yeah,
and there's something else that's as intense that you find a bit more pleasurable, there's no point in making it a punishment in and of itself. You know, you can find it tough, but, you know, don't do anything that's
I guess that's
hurt
where
you.
We're all different, isn't it? Because if I don't find it a bit hard, I don't get the same satisfaction out of it, you know? So, and I know that's probably because of a lifetime of exercise. And I think people who are new to exercise, I think that is great advice, you know, try and find something you enjoy. But if you're enjoying it too much, it might not be the thing for you. So what about, you mentioned berries in terms of the long-term health of the brain. And I mentioned the heart as well. Is it all the same stuff? No processed foods, you know, or avoiding processed foods, alcohol, you know, smoking, all the bad stuff that is bad for your heart is going to be bad for your brain.
Pretty much. Partly the things that are bad for your heart being bad for your brain is about the amount of blood vessels in your brain. So if you think about your cardiovascular system, we tend to be thinking about the heart and your arteries and your veins. But there are 400 miles of blood vessels in your brain. So keeping those flexible, clear and healthy is really important as well. Because we know that if they begin to narrow, if they become blocked, then that's a stroke, or that's, you know, reduced opportunity of access to energy for your brain cells. And if your brain cells can't store energy, so the rest of your body has fat storage, can store energy, your brain cannot store energy. So if there is an energy crisis in your brain, if for some reason those nutrients from the bloodstream can't get to your brain cells, they will just die. So making sure you're taking care of those blood vessels in your brain as well is really important. In terms of kind of nutrition specifically for the brain, just a few key things. So omega-3 fatty acids is a really important part of the flexibility of your brain cells. They do a wide range of things. Leafy green vegetables, they have been associated with 11 years younger brain aging in older people. So a daily serving of leafy greens has been shown to really slow brain aging. And there was that new study on Alzheimer's disease that found that these carotenoids, which are found in leafy green vegetables and brightly coloured fruits and vegetables, in post-mortem brains of people with Alzheimer's, there was a 50% reduction in those carotenoids. Now, we're not 100% sure about that. It tracks with the rest of the evidence, so we need to kind of follow that up. But those leafy green vegetables, brightly coloured fruits and vegetables, they help improve the flexibility of those brain cells. They help to protect your brain cells against chemical stressors as well. And those omega-3s that help to keep inflammation down and keep your brain membranes nice and flexible. Those would be the kind of key ones.
I guess it's a balancing act as an elite athlete, isn't it, Helen? In terms of you're doing everything that is being mentioned there in terms of the exercise, your diet, I'm sure is brilliant. And you've got the full range of vegetables and fruit that you need to have in your diet. But of course, you're putting yourself under a lot of stress as well in terms of your body. How does that kind of work for you in terms of the balance? And do you think about that, the amount of stress you put yourself under?
Yeah, I think it's probably most obvious when you're under so much stress that you feel like you're on the edge of illness or injury, because that's when normally you would just step back and the instinct would be, well, today I won't do this.
Mm. Yeah, that's what I can do, but you can't do that.
It's a real battle, and it's a real, if you make a wrong step, you could take yourself out of training for a week because you do get ill or you do get injured. And so I think there's definitely, it's a communication thing between coaches and doctors and yourself. And there's also a kind of a sense of knowing yourself and being confident enough to advocate for yourself as well, because it's really hard. Most of this four-year Olympic cycle, you're competing against everybody to try and make it into the boat. And you do not want to be the one that puts their hand up and says, I think I'm getting a cold. And if you don't do it on that day, you might miss a week of training. So it is really hard to kind of get that balance right. And most of the time, I think my tendency is to push the gamble too hard and keep going when maybe the sensible thing would be to stop. But that is also probably my instinct as well.
And did you find, like a lot of new mums do when their kids go to nursery and school and they're bringing home all the coughs and colds, you know, from school, did you find yourself being better at warding those off or more nervous about those things?
I was really anticipating this.
Yeah.
I was thinking as soon as they start nursery, I'm going to get everything. But actually, interestingly, I was okay. You know, Steve actually got a lot of the things that I didn't get. And so I found that really interesting, because especially I'm under training stress. My body is almost always on the edge. And I don't know if it's something about being an athlete and being healthy or whether it's something about being a mum and getting that immunity. But I think it's really interesting.
And Kimberly, just finally, on the brain and exercise and the links, the government guidelines, 150 minutes, did you say?
Yes, I think so. It's 150 minutes of moderate activity, 75 if your activity is more vigorous.
Okay, and for anybody who really wants to do the bare minimum, that is what could keep your brain healthy for longer.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are some beautiful studies that demonstrate that even brisk walking, so 40 minutes three times a week, was enough to effectively reverse brain aging by leading to an increase in the size of the hippocampus. So if people are kind of getting back into exercise, if they are returning from injury, if they feel just overwhelmed by the idea that fitness means training for an Ironman, then they need to know that actually you can start small, and as long as you're kind of staying consistent, you're going to get these benefits. And every time you move, you are giving your brain a boost.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Kimberly. As always, it's great to chat to you. We will hopefully see you again soon on The Midpoint. Helen, here we are a few months away from Paris. When's the final date for you in terms of selection?
So around Easter time, I'll hopefully know for sure that I'll be going in which boat.
And all being well, everything being equal, that's looking good at the moment. Obviously, you have to plan for that.
I think so, yeah. I think you have to train assuming that everything will be good, yeah.
And in Paris, we will hopefully see you on the rostrum once more and probably saying something like, that's it, no more for me. And then we'll go, yeah, all right, Helen. We'll wait and see what happens in 2 years' time. It doesn't feel to me like you're ready to completely close the chapter yet.
I mean, I've learned to never say never, I guess.
Yeah, well, it's going well for you, that strategy. Helen, it's been a joy to chat to you. Thank you so much for sparing the time out of your camp. What's next, a weight session?
Yep, I've got weights in about half an hour, so.
All right, so quick lie down, call home. What are you going to do?
I'll FaceTime home, yeah.
You go FaceTime home. We don't want to keep you from the kids anymore. Say hi to Steve for me, won't you?
I will.
He's been on a rugby program that I do in Wales, and I know he's a big rugby fan, isn't he? And
yeah, he is.
I'm sure he's a big rowing fan these days, but.
I don't know about that.
Well done. Yeah. I think he might hate it.
Yeah.
well done anyway for having a partner that is all in and that, you know, the team is working well.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been great to chat to you.
And you. I always love chatting to Helen, and whether she sees it or not, she really is a trailblazer for women in sport and an inspiration for working women at large too, showing that despite all the demands on your time and energy, you shouldn't walk away from something you love when you feel you still have lots to give. And Kimberly had some brilliant advice as well, didn't she? If brain health interests you, Kimberly's books, How to Build a Healthy Brain and Unprocessed, How the Food We Eat is Fueling Our Mental Health Crisis, are out now. You may also like to listen to her podcast, Made of Stronger Stuff, on BBC Sounds. If you're new to The Midpoint, do scroll back through our extensive archive for more chats with well-known midlifers and hit follow wherever you're listening so that you don't miss the latest episode. Thanks again to my brilliant guests, to Spiritland Creative, and to you for keeping me company. I'll be back next week. Bye for now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.